This is Bonnie Goldman. I'm with thebodypro.com. I'm here with Greg Smiley, who's the Director of Public Policy and Government Relations at the American Academy of HIV Medicine, arguably the most largest group of HIV specialists. Greg is going to tell us a little bit about what he does in his job. Can you tell me a little bit about the Ryan White Care Act, for instance?
Sure. The Ryan White Care Act is the largest discretionary funded source of public care for people with HIV and AIDS. And what that means is that people that don't qualify for other public systems of care, such as Medicare and Medicaid, can rely on Ryan White Care Act services for their treatment, for their supportive health services, some other ancillary service needs to supplement their care that they don't otherwise receive through public or private insurance. The Ryan White Care Act is funded about $2 billion a year right now, which is quite a long way from when it was originally enacted in 1990. The law was passed overwhelmingly by both Democrats and Republicans back in 1990 to help people that weren't otherwise accessing care. And because of the exponential expansions in available treatments, in certainly the number of people with HIV in this country, the program has also really exponentially grown since 1990, and is certainly an anchor of care for people in this country. Medicare and Medicaid may be slightly larger programs for people with HIV, but because the CARE Act is funded annually by Congress and is rewritten by Congress every 5 years, it gets a lot more attention necessarily than maybe the Medicare or Medicaid programs do. And so it ends up being much more in the public consciousness, much more in the minds and hearts of advocates, of physicians, of patients, because they see the program being changed and being funded every so often, as opposed to the entitlement programs of Medicare and Medicaid.
So it was supposed to be reenacted last year on September 30th, I understand, and it's still not reenacted. What's taken so long?
Well, Congress certainly is not known for getting things done on time. They tend to be procrastinators on a number of different issues, certainly not just on the Ryan White Care Act. The Ryan White Care Act has certain authorization periods, just like other laws do. Anything that is funded by the government has to be authorized to be funded. And so even other agencies that we're much more familiar with, such as the CDC, NIH, and other agencies, have to be written into law by Congress. And Congress likes to be significantly hands-on or in touch with how agencies are run. And so when they set up laws, they authorize them only for a finite period of time. And the Ryan White Care Act is no exception. Now, Congress has two functions. Not only do they write the laws, but then they fund those programs that are authorized. So Congress's two aims, authorization and appropriations, are both extremely important, but they're also different. The NIH, for example, hasn't been reauthorized since 1993, and obviously it's a very popular program, and it's not in any danger of going anywhere or being not funded from year to year. Uh-huh. So even though technically it's illegal or not appropriate, Congress does certainly fund these programs year after year without any worry that they're going to go away. So the last time the CARE Act was reauthorized was in 2000 for another five-year period, which the fiscal year for the federal government begins on October 1 every year. So the law technically expired on September 30th in 2005. But like I said, it's in no danger of going anywhere or not being funded. And so Congress has been funding it annually with their appropriations bills. The law always has, except for in 1990 when it was passed, it always has a certain level of interest among members of Congress in terms of how they want to have it redone. And I think as the years have gone and the partisanship in Washington has increased, and as the disease prevalence has increased and the funding levels haven't gone sort of at the same rate that the HIV prevalence has gone, that people are starting to be much more concerned about how the law is written and how it's funded, and it becomes a little bit much more of an interest for folks, because because these services are life-saving and they really do have an impact on people, and so people become much more invested over time, and it's become a little bit, because the funding hasn't necessarily matched the needs, it has become much more of a political fireball.
How involved is the Academy in lobbying or working to get this reenactment? I mean, how much time have you spent on it, and do you spend on it?
Well, the Academy is an organization that's only been around for about 6 years, and for the first 2 or 3 years of its existence, didn't have any kind of public policy arm to it. Just to clarify what the Academy is, it's an organization of about 2,000 medical providers throughout the country who credential as HIV specialists. They are about 30% infectious disease docs. Many are internal medicine docs, but we also have family practitioners, general practitioners, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants as well, because HIV care isn't housed under any one sort of subspecialty of medicine, that you could be any different type of medical provider and specialize in HIV care. And so what the Academy does is bind those people together through regular education and credentialing programs to keep medical providers up to date. And what they found in 2003 is that they really wanted to get much more involved in advocating on behalf of their patients. So they hired me and to design and create and run a public policy program, which is probably our most popular, one of the most popular programs that we offer and share. So the Ryan White Care Act has certainly been one of the top priorities of my work over the past 3 years. Certainly there have been other things that we've been focused on, such as the Medicare Part D, the prescription drug benefit, the cuts that Medicaid has been facing both on the federal level and the state level. We certainly have worked on NIH reauthorization, on the CDC counseling and testing guidelines, for example. But Ryan White has tended to be the anchor of our public policy program. We co-authored a position paper, a white paper, on what our feelings were on the Ryan White Care Act reauthorization with the HIV Medicine Association. The HIV Medicine Association is another organization of HIV specialists, specifically those physicians that specialize in infectious disease. But the two organizations work arm in arm when it comes to many public policy issues, and the Ryan White Care Act was certainly one that we're quite proud of to have worked together on. We came out with a white paper that talked about the prioritization of medical services, which we fairly broadly defined to encompass more than what the conventional wisdom for medical care is. It certainly is much more than doctor's visits, lab tests, and prescriptions. And we recognize that there are other things that make up what healthcare is for people. So we advocated for the addition of substance abuse services, mental health services, a lot of other arms of healthcare services to be included in the prioritization of medical care when Congress looked to reauthorize the CARE Act. We also made suggestions on the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, that all states adhere to a certain level of basic medications that they include on their formularies. And we asked the federal government to guarantee that for every individual in those states that were 300% of the federal poverty level or below. Prescription drug medications and availability really do vary from state to state. Some states barely cover much more than just the antiretrovirals that we know and depend on. Other states, such as New Jersey, Massachusetts, and New York, do a great job of augmenting those basic formularies with a lot of other, hundreds of other drugs that people depend on. So what we are hoping to do is make sure that every individual that doesn't have access to medications has access to a clinical standard of care, both under the AIDS Drug Assistance Program and throughout the other arms of the Ryan White Care Act. So we advocated for the prioritization of medical services, which we broadly defined. And actually, Congress listened to what we had to say about those medical services and came out with a definition of core medical services that pretty closely mirrors the language that the HIV and Medicine Association and the Academy came up with. They also endorsed a minimum formulary under the AIDS Drug Assistance Program. They didn't necessarily guarantee it the way that we would have liked to with appropriations, but they did recognize that folks throughout the country with HIV do deserve a clinical standard of minimum standard of care under drugs. We also were quite supportive of bringing in new language that would help bring in new HIV medical providers. We see that folks really aren't going into HIV medicine like they used to, and we'd like to use the Ryan White Care Act to demonstrate the fact that folks aren't going into HIV medicine like they used to, and without taking any dollars away from medical care to fund programs, we did want the Ryan White Care Act to look at ways that we could identify bringing new folks into care. So we've been quite active in working with Congress, with the administration, with the White House on revising the CARE Act to the best that they could. And you know, I think like any other advocacy organization, you'd say we won some battles, we lost some battles, but the patient's concerns have always been at the forefront of the physician's mind, and they've been excited to work on it, and it's been exciting to work on it on their behalf.
Did you do a white coat day or something? You brought a lot of physicians to Washington?
We did. It's been it's been interesting that in the 25 years of the epidemic, the level of advocacy among medical providers has always been fairly, I don't want to say weak, but it certainly hasn't matched the levels that the patients and that community groups really have done. So it's nice to see medical providers advocating on behalf of their patients and becoming more involved in state advocacy and federal advocacy and so forth. And in 2003, we brought in a number of our members to lobby the Hill and wear their white coats and storm the Capitol like Mr. Smith and, well, Dr. Smith goes to Washington. We've done that 3 years in a row now, and we certainly do enjoy that. It's one of our signature events that is very beneficial both from our members' viewpoints and those on the Hill. Members of Congress have been quite appreciative of the fact that the stakeholder community of the docs have been coming in and voicing their opinions. And it's obviously been very rewarding for the doctors themselves to see advocacy in motion and see some results from it.
So what's the status of the CARE Act today? I understand that certain states like New York, California, New Jersey are very worried that they're going to lose money because of the way it's been changed. So could you tell me a little bit about where we're at today and whether physicians or patients need to worry in the future?
Well, the biggest problem, and it always comes down to money, the unfortunate aspect of the last few years of members of Congress and how they look to appropriate monies for programs, it hasn't been a very rosy picture. And working under the assumption, it's not even an assumption, it's a sort of stated fact that health programs and other discretionarily funded programs really aren't going to see major increases anytime soon. With that being the framework that we're working under, there unfortunately are going to be winners and losers. It's not how we would like to shape the debate. It's just the reality of the situation, which is unfortunate, and that it's difficult to recognize that. But it's in some ways, at the moment, has to be dealt with and accepted. And the unfortunate situation is that under this bill or under current law, either way, they're going to be winners and losers without, with the Ryan White Care Act being reauthorized as it's currently drafted, or without it being reauthorized and current law being kept into place. If you want me to go a little bit into the about how that works, I'm happy to do that.
Yeah.
When the CARE Act was last reauthorized in 2000, cases were the funding for states and for cities was based on a weighted band, an average of AIDS cases over the past 10 years. How that was done might get a little technical and complicated, but it suffice it to say it was based just on AIDS cases. And they recognized that HIV is not just AIDS, it is the whole spectrum of care, and that people earlier on in their infection need to get care. And so they said, we want to start documenting where HIV cases are as well as AIDS cases, because the funding should recognize that and follow the epidemic accordingly.
Let me interrupt. Is it that they wanted not all AIDS reflects the older population of infected people and not the newer population? It affects, it also doesn't it reflect 10 years ago,
right,
rather than today? I mean, is that
right,
more or less?
Yeah, what they did was they said, for all the cases that you, for example, in 2002, they to find out how much they would give you, they would say, well, the cases that were documented or diagnosed in 1992, we'll give you $10 for them. And for those done in 1993, we'll give you $15, and so on. And those cases for that were diagnosed last year, we'll give you $90 per case. So it was weighting the cases based on your most recent infections, but at the same time was counting those cases that were diagnosed 8, 9, 10 years ago in your formula for your funding. And you know, this is more commonly known by how people say, well, we're counting dead people, because people that were diagnosed in 1992 were still being counted in their formulas. And a lot of those folks had died, but you're still getting the money for them. So Congress said, well, let's count HIV as well as AIDS and have money being dispersed based on HIV prevalence and AIDS prevalence. So that was to take in effect by October 1. Now, they said that they would only count those HIV cases if the CDC recognized them as being truly identified HIV cases, meaning that the cases were reported to the CDC in a way that CDC would accept it. And this is commonly known as names-based versus code-based reporting. When this law became in effect in 2000, a lot of the states throughout the country that had code-based data started to recognize that they were going to lose out come October 1, 2007, and they started switching over to a names-based system. California is the last big state known to have switched over from code-based reporting to names-based reporting just earlier this year. And there still are 11 or 12 states, including the District of Columbia, that do not diagnose and report cases of HIV infection by a person's name and report that to the federal government. So come October 1, which is basically Saturday, those formulas for the next fiscal year, which again begins on October 1, will be based on what the CDC has in their systems for HIV cases and AIDS cases. And if you don't have HIV cases in the system that they recognize, you're not going to get the dollars for it. Now, there are protections within the way the CARE Act is funded. It's a very complicated program. The way funding is allocated is funding is funded first on the front end through your formula award, and then later on the back end, later in the year, in what's known as a supplemental award. And the supplemental award is there to protect those localities that may not have gotten everything that they needed. So those states that don't have HIV case reporting in place by October 1 won't get a very strong formula award on the front end of the fiscal cycle, but in theory will get the priority of the supplemental dollars that are awarded later in the year, because they will see that they have gotten significantly less money and they will be need to be made whole, as Congress calls it. So in order to make those grantees whole, those supplemental dollars will be prioritized for those states that lose out. Now, under the draft bill of the reauthorized CARE Act, the way that would work is states that have newer epidemics, such as in Tennessee or Alabama, perhaps, or Oklahoma and so forth, would get more money up front to recognize that the HIV epidemic has grown in those localities. And unfortunately, in a fairly flat-funded scenario, those dollars have to come from somewhere. And so states like New York, New Jersey, California, and other places may lose out. And again, there are supplemental dollars that are built into a reauthorized CARE Act that would, in theory, make those states whole, New York, New Jersey, and Illinois, and so forth. Actually, Illinois does okay in the reauthorized CARE Act. So there's winners and losers no matter which way you go. From our perspective as HIV medical providers, and we wrote a letter to Congress just last week restating what we feel, this isn't the best bill in the world. The Democrats and the Republicans from both the House and the Senate have all been working with one another to create a compromise that in some ways is this very delicate house of cards that has a lot of things that nobody likes, that has all these moving parts in it, trying to please different constituency groups, different formula funding shifts, that it's a very complicated bill. But because it does prioritize care that people need, because it does more evenly distribute those dollars throughout the country, and because it does involve a $70 million increase under the Title II awards for the states, it's better than current law. It's not heads and shoulders above current law, but at the end of the day, if your choice is between current law and this bill, this new bill is better. And so we are in support of it. It's kind of, you know, it's putting your arms around a pig and giving it a kiss. You don't love it, but you got to do it. So,
when I had asked you earlier a little about Clinton and Schumer, the New York people who are really fighting the bill, does this mean that patients or physicians living in New York or in California or New Jersey, which seem to be most worried, they're going to see something happen once the bill is passed, or if it's not? Is something concrete going to happen within the year? Will services change? Will patients suddenly lose the ability to get transportation to their physician? Anything that we should know about?
Well, I think the devil is always in the details, and there could be possibilities that services could be interrupted. There won't be anything immediate. There won't be anything that is so certain in terms of going from day to night in such a way that I think people have to be panicked about or worried about by any stretch of the imagination. In the Beltway, there's a term called hold harmless, and what that means is that from year to year, states should not, they should be held harmless from drastic funding reductions. So if you were to base your funding, for example, on your HIV incidence, this is just completely hypothetical, but if I were to give you $1 million for every case you had, if one year you had 50 cases and the next year you had 10, you would see someone's funding go up and down like a zigzag, and it would be, that's no way to fund a program, a clinic, to hire staff and to retain them and so forth. So held harmless provisions are there to keep systems of care relatively stable. And I think that we'll see that whether or not this bill is passed or not, because the hold harmless language keeps programs fairly intact and stable. It will be a while before we see any kind of major reduction in services. And the hope is that there will be adjustments made either by the state legislatures, by private organizations, by other community-based organizations to contribute more dollars to supplement these services, so that hopefully no one will go without, and that is the hope.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Greg.
Sure.